This episode is brought to you in part by Regent College, Vancouver, Canada. Experience God's call to a life more abundant with our 1 to 2 week summer courses. Sign up today at rgnt.net/summer.
Hey, Cultivated listeners. I couldn't be more excited to have my guests today be Skip and Tim Shelmathini from Roman Candle.
There's a pine warbler sitting on a hollow limb. He seems to have the whole morning out right in front of him. And everything he sings from the branch that he's sitting on, it seems to hush the leaves and the colors all around. Now first he sings and then he goes. And what it means, it's hard to know.
From Harbor Media, you're listening to Cultivated, conversations about faith and work. Today, it's Roman Candle Day, the band you're listening to right now, whose song we've been using as our theme song. We talk about being a husband and wife in a band, about why so much of Christian music sucks, and about how their faith has changed and shifted over the years. And we'll get to listen to some of their music along the way.
We met on an Outward Bound program in the High Sierras. I was going to be a senior in high school, and Skip was a Moorhead at Caroline, and that was part of the Moorhead scholarship. So we met there and just immediately hit it off as really good friends, and then went home and tried to date other people and called each other, and we're like, we should get married.
We were total babies, though. I mean, like, she was 17, my mother, I was 18. So we were absolute babies. And it was the summer before my freshman year in college. And we met in the Fresno airport, like that was where you met. Then you went into the Mount Whitney country or whatever and hiked for 3 weeks. And Outward Bound is, they're all about no exclusive relationships. You know, like, when we didn't have an exclusive relationship on Outward Bound, we were sort of leaving after that. We realized that, wow.
So how long between meeting and saying, let's get married?
Oh, like maybe 3 months.
And we were, which is really unlike both of us. Like we were, well, you were probably more primed to get married young, but I was like anti-marriage thinking way down the line, but it was kind of undeniable. And so we always hesitate to tell people that because we got married at 19 and 20. And for the first 5 years, we were like, everyone should get married young. And then we were like, that's not true.
So my wife and I's story is almost identical. We met because she was dating my best friend when I was a junior. They went to prom together. And this guy and I, we've been friends for 25 years. We're still friends.
Yeah.
So we have these really awkward prom pictures of my wife and him together. And then like a year later, when we were 18, we started dating. And like 3 months into dating, we were like, we really need to get married. And of course, our families freak out.
That's so good.
And then I would say the exact same thing. Like we got married at 19. And for the first 5 years, we were like, everybody should get married. And now we look at it and we see kids that are like 19 and we're like, oh my gosh, you're an idiot.
Don't do it. Yeah. It totally works for some people. Thank God it worked for us.
For sure. But it's so tough.
It's really tough.
When did music come into each of your lives?
You kept telling me even when we were dating that you wanted to be a rock star.
I didn't take him seriously.
I never would have married him.
That's true, especially knowing you now. I'm glad
I'm glad
you didn't believe me.
I never would have gone for that.
I mean, I think you should say before you even met me.
I don't know where music is in my history. I mean, I'm just like a lover of music, and I was a writer. He was playing a ton of music, and I played music all growing up, but I never thought that I wanted to be in a band or anything. And then when we got our first record deal, we were up all night writing records, and it was like, well, if we're going to do this, we're going to do this together because this just wouldn't work with two separate things.
Did Roman Candle start with just you?
Just Logan and Skip.
It's me. Going back to when my dad was a musician, like a jazz musician in the mountains of North Carolina, which is a hot jazz scene for the most part. He was an engineer, like a studio engineer, and he was a band director in high school. He just did a lot of music stuff off and on for his whole life. He wasn't like a touring musician when we were kids. And in fact, he was sort of like against the idea. And he still is a music minister and, you know, like... But he'd sort of played in bars his younger days and was like, yeah, I kind of want to protect you guys from that. Yeah, so we started playing music when we were in high school. We moved kind of out into the country from like a neighborhood in the town we lived in. That was great, actually, because we kind of, Logan and I as friends, like as brothers, like kind of became better friends because we didn't have people to hang out with. And we just started playing music in the basement. And we got a four track and, kind of imagine how that unfolds. But
I think it's one of the things that people don't even think about. Those experiences of making a record on a four track as a kid, like you learn so much.
Yeah.
You need those early stages. You know, I think a lot of people think, well, if we just play music, someday someone's going to come along and get me signed. But it's really the grind of like starting when you're a kid. And
oh, yeah. And it's making really bad demos, writing bad songs that allows you to kind of listen back and go, because you think it's really good the first time you're doing, like, this is great, man. I think this is something here. And then, like, then you go and listen to anything else than that one bad cassette tape. And you go, oh, man, what we just did is awful. There's nothing worse out there, I think. You know, like, and then yeah. I think that's such an essential piece of getting anywhere with writing.
And you kept saying, like, you wanted to be a songwriter. And he's a year ahead of me in school. And so we kind of were going to have a year where he would just be waiting anyways. I was like, you should take a semester off and write songs and see if this is, like, something you can actually do, if you can write songs. So that went over super well with his dad. did not go over well. But you took a year off and wrote songs that year. And then my senior year, we went home to his parents' house and recorded them that whole year. And then when we graduated, we actually moved back to Portland and we're like, we got internships at Mojo and Q. And we're going to just go over and write and try to just like serve coffee for them. And September 11th happened and they kind of froze all
We were leaving on September the 13th or something.
So we just stayed and worked in Portland and got a record deal like 3 months later.
We had just got out of college and I was driving a forklift in a plumbing warehouse and Tim Shell was washing dishes in like an art college. And then we had our music on like garageband.com this is a wacky story, but like how we got a record deal was a current NFL player at that time, who's now retired, his name was Trevor Price, and he was looking to create a record label and he really loved the band Gorillaz. He was like, I want to find a band like Gorillaz. I don't know how he landed on us and our demos. We didn't sound like... I don't know. It sounded like we listened to like our DJ biggest Shadow influence was like DJ Shadow back then. We didn't even know anything about sampling. I thought DJ Shadow played all the stuff on that record for the most part, except for the actual like voices. I was like, wow, you know, that was our big like to make the drums sound like this. And so like he said that's sort of what drew. Yeah. But we got an email. This is like in an AOL account that like was on our website. It was like, hey, I'm starting a record label. I play for the Denver Broncos. And we're like, spam. And like we didn't, you know, we wrote him back because it did seem like a real person had written the email, but I was like, this is totally not real. And I didn't have a cell phone or anything. And I was like, if you want to call me, I didn't believe it was going to happen. I was like, I work at this warehouse. You can call me on my lunch break at noon, you know, and I got a phone call. Like, come with you. I'm scared if you got a phone call. And I was just like, that's not Tim Shaw. He doesn't have a phone where she works. You know, so it was this guy's like, hey, my name's Trevor Price. And it was like, it was real. And then, that's a long, wacky story. I still remember sitting in the Waffle House in Wilkes-Barre telling my dad, he's like, if you quit school, you're not going to go back to school. And I was like, no, I'll totally go back to school. I'll get a job. I'm just going to write. I did, too. I got my degree. But anyway, we
wrote those songs.
We wrote those songs and started to go home and record them. And then when we were both out of school, Logan was still in school. And so he'd come home on the weekends, but we were staying at my parents' house in the basement recording. That's where our studio was. We'd been building up that studio for a while and had like, you know, really ridiculous digital gear that was like, you know, this was the best we could afford at the time. And like, you know, you're trying to like do these inboard effects and these type of nerdy things. And you're like,
but that was kind of beautiful. I liked having less options. Like once we got Pro Tools, I didn't like that at all. I like not being like, this doesn't even make a sound. Let's see if we can make it make some neat sound. You know, that was fun.
Yeah, the limitations was definitely our advantage at that point. But
Trevor sent us all this gear to Skip's parents' house in Wilkes-Barre. And Logan was still living in North Carolina. So they opened it up and they didn't know how to even use it.
Wow.
So it was like in 3 months, have a record done. It was like 3 months. It was a really short time.
Yeah, it was actually 6 weeks.
Yeah. And so we learned it. The gear and made the record.
Yeah, it was like all this legit outboard gear that we still have. That's still like, I mean, it's probably like $20,000 worth of outboard gear that we'd never seen. Real legit studio stuff is like two knobs and one switch, and you're like, I don't know what this does. I don't know. You know? So that
there's
was
only three things here. Yeah. And I don't know what any of them do.
I think it took us 3 weeks to figure out how to use it, and then we made the first record that we did like in the other 3 weeks. So we'd have the songs written, but like trying to record it and use this stuff was like insane.
But when you guys have. Like your production's pretty densely layered. I mean, there's a lot going on in that. So I can imagine that felt like you had a gun against your head.
Which is good. That was good. It was super stressful, but it
funny
was good.
Story. The funny thing was, is he said, like, I'm going to send you a bunch of gear. Use it to make your record. I like the sounds you're getting out of your basement. Do that. I'm just going to send you some better gear. And I'm going to come to your house. This is my parents' house in the mountains. Like, I'm going to come to your house after my last playoff game. If we lose to Indianapolis or whatever. And like, I don't know what maybe I think it was that team.
Go Colts.
He, it's so funny. Like they lost that game. I think he was still in the Broncos then. And He left that game, flew to Charlotte. Like, we picked him up with, like, my mom and my dad in our car.
Did we go to, like, Outback or something?
Ridiculous restaurant off the highway. And my parents live, like, in a place where the streetlights kind of stop, you know what I mean? Like, and then you're kind of still driving, and it's a little creepy. And then, like, you pull off on one road. And we'd never met this guy, and he'd never met us. And then we pulled off onto a dirt road, and I was driving.
All right.
My parents in the back, Logan's in the back, Tim's in the back, and he's in the front seat, and he kind of, like, gripped his seat and goes, "You didn't tell me you lived on the dirt road." And I was like, I said, "That's all right, man. It's only 8 miles long. And it's only like a half mile long." He was, "8 miles." And it was great. Anyway, but he slept in my parents' bed. Like, my parents slept in our bed. It was nerve wracking. But we got tight with Trevor.
Yeah, we did.
That's amazing. Which record's that?
That was Says Pop that turned into the Wee Hour Review. So, like, yeah, the super long story short, we made that record, and then
he sold it later.
Yeah, he tried to put it out, you know, and kind of, like, got bored with running a record label because it's
so much work. Yeah.
And also, it was like the music business was starting to tank in general. So he was like, I'm going to jump ship, and sold it to
Hollywood,
which then the Wee Hour Review record we made on Hollywood, it got shelved. 3 years later, V2 bought it and put it out. So it was, by the time it came out in 2006, it was like a very different record to us. But.
And did you guys tour on that record when you first put it out?
Yes.
Yeah, we toured for like 2 or 3 years before it came out. And then after it came out, we kind of toured for 10 years off and on. And that record was like 5 years of that, I would guess.
Mm-hmm. As the night comes in, watch the buildings out the window start to fade. Well, there's people down by the street that knew this neighborhood before the bricks were laid. And if they couldn't get away, they'll walk to the bar and ordered up a rum and lemonade. Gets me thinking about just passing time and trying to get by, leaning out the window just to listen to the sirens go by.
Talk to me about kind of when faith becomes a part of your life. You grew up in the church, and
you go.
Yeah, I grew up in a.
Your dad was a music minister.
And I grew up in the same bed of church my whole life. Had a great youth group. Youth pastor was Roy Dobbins. He was amazing. I had a great experience with that. I got to college, and I did not have any idea that theology was a thing. I probably had never heard that word until I got to college, or maybe in high school. You know, like, but like, sure. Got to college and then started to take philosophy classes and sort of like learned that theology was a thing. And like there were thinkers like St. Augustine and, you know, Duns Scotus and St. Thomas Aquinas. And like all these, like, you know, the Middle Ages was like a big
influence.
Yeah, pretty much. We took
influenced by the Middle Ages.
I'm super influenced by the Middle Ages.
I had lapsed Catholic faith background. Okay. So like I'm the oldest of three and was baptized and confirmed, and then it just kind of was nothing that we did, being from the West Coast. I mean, there's plenty of wonderful Christians of all stripes on the West Coast, just not in my family. My dad was like a California surfer. Mm. That was very, very liberal. And we had a professor at Carolina, Dr. Kirkpatrick, our firstborn is actually named after him. And he was an English literature professor, and he just had a curiosity and an appetite and a wonder that was just infectious and unparalleled. And he was an incredible man. But he was a Catholic. But looking back, you're like, obviously, that's everything that he was talking about. But he just had such an appetite for everything, just, and that was really infectious. And so we came from really different backgrounds. And I think because of him, we're able to find a middle road. And so we became Catholic.
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, 100%. And like, I think the thing that was so great about him was all bets were on. There was no...
Yeah, nothing.
You know, like,
was
you reason
off
like Southern Baptist Church, there's a lot of like no dancing, no, you know, like there's like, you know, but it's like until you get out of that setup in your mind, like you don't think, well, what's the consequences here? Like we went to college at UNC Chapel Hill, and we, you know, there was two Jewish people in Wilkesboro,
right.
And there were you know, married. I mean, like, they, you know, they that I knew of, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, they had to go to Winston-Salem to go to synagogue. I don't know if they did that or not. But, like, yeah. it wasn't right. the most diverse community right. ever. So, yeah, like, you know, you get to college and all of a sudden you start asking, you're like, wow, what does everything mean
yeah.
based on the first 18 years of my life? I have no idea. So, you know.
Somehow we got married and without even having that conversation, yeah, which is totally. Crazy. Again, yeah. things we probably don't recommend yeah. anyone else.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. yeah, we got married and we were like, and I was like, well.
Because most of the time when you hear people like say, yeah, we got married at 19, like they're like serious evangelical Christians.
Totally. So yeah, my dad was like, you're gonna get married. You're going to go down there. You're going to be pregnant in a year. Like he was this is a bad idea.
Yeah. I know.
Nope, it didn't happen that way.
We didn't, but we had zero theological discussion going. Uh-uh. We were like, we both sort of vaguely had said, we believe in God and we believe in Jesus. And to me, that meant one thing. That meant like my Southern Baptist upbringing. Yeah. I'm like, well, obviously Tim Shell believes in this checklist of things.
Almost assumed.
And then as soon as we got married, Tim Shell was like,
the Jesus thing's a little weird.
She's like, that is a problem, actually. And I was like, whoa, you know, like this is really heavy duty. You know,
lots
like,
of talk.
We're already married at that stage. And we're like, what does it mean? So anyway, we started
I think
reading.
That was good because it was good for you too. Like there was things you hadn't talked about and you were in a certain place and I was in a certain place and we really were able to find a third place. That was complete, even though my family had a Catholic background. I mean, it wasn't even in our cultural mythology. Like, it wasn't even in our family.
Sure.
We went to London for a summer with this professor, and we went to Brompton Oratory.
Yeah.
Incredible parish. And they stood up and said the creed. And I was like, I do not believe in one holy Catholic church. Like, I stood up and said it. And it was just like, just real out of it. One of our friends who was another graduate student was teaching a C.S. Lewis class on the Great Divorce at a Catholic parish that was an hour. It was in Raleigh.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, you should come and read this book. And that book was far out there enough and weird enough and kind of like hairy enough for us to both think it was interesting and not just like evangelical in that way, just trying to say something. And so we started to read it. And as we were driving back and forth halfway back, we were like, oh my gosh, I think we're going to do the RCIA class. Like, this is weird.
Well, yeah, it was really, we took one Lewis class on the Great Divorce at that church under this grad student that we loved. Yeah. He's actually still teaches at Belmont Abbey.
Yeah.
His name's Al Benthal. He's one of my favorite people in the world. He was kind of the right-hand guy to the professor that we loved. And so, I mean, if they had said like, you guys should take a class on the, I don't know, whatever the most boring thing ever. We'd have taken whatever they had suggested because they were not boring people and they didn't get involved in boring things and they were incredibly intelligent. So we were like, yeah, you're teaching a class on which book? Four Loves. C.S. Lewis. Sounds great. I think we did the Four Loves. We did the Great Divorce. And then they were like, hey, if you want to stick around, like RCIA is next. We're like, what's RCIA? And like, it's like a September to Easter class. If you stick around through the whole thing, and you want to, you can become a Catholic, but you have to do this to become a Catholic. I'm like, that's not even on our radar, but we went and then
there we were.
We jumped in and it was, it was where we were supposed to be.
Watch your imaginations and
dreams. Yeah. Yeah. And also like, I don't think until we got to Nashville, we met other Catholics that were our age that actually chose to be Catholic. So we've always kind of been like the weird ones in the room.
I know.
That's normal.
I worked in a restaurant at that time because we had just, I think I had just graduated and Tim Schill was almost graduated and this kind of like party bro restaurant kind of thing. Right. You know, I was waiting tables and these guys were like, dude, come party with us. And I was like, no, I've got to drive to Raleigh. Oh, what are you driving to Raleigh for? Well, I'm converting to Catholicism. And they were like, oh, dude, crazy, man. And I'm like, what? Are you getting married? And I was like,
nobody goes that direction.
Yeah. It was like, they were like, you getting married? I'm like, I'm actually already married. I've been married for a couple years. Like, that's even weirder, man. Insane. Yeah. He's like, even is she a Catholic? I'm like, well, we're both joining together. Like, so you don't have any background in the Catholic Church? Like, no, you don't have to get, you know,
where's
become
the outside
Catholic?
Pressure?
Yeah even from. The people in the church would be like, what? What are you doing?
Yeah. It was great.
Well, so it's kind of all these things happen at once. Like your marriage starts to develop, your faith starts to develop, your music starts to develop. Is it all intertwined kind of in your minds and your imaginations or?
Yeah. Pretty much. The frying pan was hot at that point. Like there was a lot of stuff in it. And what's funny is like Logan and I and Tim Shaw especially, we were entirely innocent of Christian music and honestly still are. Like we just don't know.
Yeah.
Being in town here, it's been a huge like, I have no idea when people are name dropping because they're just like, dude, that was so-and-so. And I'm just like, amazing. I have no idea what you're talking about. Like, that was really funny. So like faith and music, you know, in that way, like there was never a temptation or a
desire actually to combine that.
So it was
to do faith music. Is that true? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
we definitely needed our faith to be in the music industry.
Yeah, but as far as like those two things, which are incredibly overlapped for so many people, were like never even like in the same room. For us, music was like these secular bands, and it was like painting or something. I don't know. It was like this is an art form. It was work.
It was like
I mean, and songwriting was like it wasn't like there was no. It never was anything.
Just worship music wasn't what we were going to do ever.
That's true, and there was no like I'm actually kind of grateful there was not and there's nothing wrong with this in the world, but I'm grateful there wasn't a praise band or something. So in my church, there was just like a guy with a piano. And so that like when I started to play music with my brother in the basement, it wasn't like, oh, you know, we're going to.
Yeah.
I mean, as soon as we left, they got a praise band and they actually came up with a great band out of that band. It was like another bunch of little great songwriters. But like, anyway.
We had a couple people that we worked with really early on that were new Christians, and it was like a big conversation for them. You know what your vocation is artistically. You know where you're supposed to fit sometimes. That was the thing about that professor, is it was like a lot of our professors at UNC, it was like there wasn't secular and faith as far as the artists or the writers or the thinkers, and that just wasn't what it was. It was like people that were saying good things and doing good work in their realm. And that's just kind of how we approached music. And it came out in a certain shape, and that's what happened. But there was people we would work with that would put that pressure on us. Like, what are you going to say here? And what are you going to say? And we were so young that it would feel like we had to really consider that and like discern if that was their thing that they needed to deal with, or if it was something that we needed to deal with, you know, what was appropriate for us.
Just that pressure to be like, Christians, you should be singing about Jesus at every song.
Yeah, like, can you be in this magazine, or can you do this? And you know, those are all discerning decisions that you make, but it's not as, it's not as one-to-one. It's a little bit more nuanced.
So for you guys, music was more like, in a sense, it was like, hey, here's this whole marketplace. Like, here's this whole world that we want to participate in. Not necessarily like, there was nothing that attracted you to the Christian subculture.
Well, you know, it existed really. And there was one poster on our youth group wall of Al Denson. It was like a poster. That was like our decoration. Yeah. I mean, other than that, it was like maybe sports stuff, like, you know, go Carolina or go Tennessee Vols or like whatever. Sure. Like, that's not downplaying the fact that like we did it, I loved our youth group and everything was like incredible. And the youth pastor was just unbelievable. There wasn't a big, like, when we got in our youth van, honestly, they listened to Lynyrd Skynyrd and Neil Young and like, you know, certain songs they didn't listen to, but like, you know, that was sort of like, it wasn't like, okay, now we're going to listen to Petra or whatever. Like, my dad did buy Logan and I a Christian tape one time of Petra and like it lasted for like 10 minutes. And I always felt guilty when I didn't listen to it. So I was like, oh, I should probably be throwing on that thing. It doesn't sound as good as like Def Leppard or whatever. It was like ridiculous. You know, like,
it just felt like there's artistically too, we were participating in a different conversation. Like, I think when you're doing praise and worship music, there's a conversation you're definitely engaging with and you feel compelled to. And that just wasn't the conversation that we were
participating in. Yeah, vocation's that's a huge thing for us. And it was honestly like an artistic angle. Our success or lack of success, I think, is reflected in the fact that like we were like, felt called to do this one thing. And we thought it was going to be like, wow, that's going to be incredibly successful. Not because we thought we were doing market research or whatever. We just thought, sounds good to us. So obviously it's going to sound good to everybody. Not the case. Like, but, some freezing rain is falling on my shoulder.
Talk to me about, like, now sort of years later, you've been doing the work, you know, you've been walking with your faith for the season. Like, do you feel like your faith informs your work or the way you think about beauty or the way you think about art?
Yeah, absolutely. We were talking about it last night because I was like, I think the intoxicating thing about talking to artists about the creative process. One, it's really fun just to get them to be able to talk about it on a practical level, because there's no one way to do it. It's completely mysterious, but it's really like love, because you're just, it's so joyful and so painful all in one thing. But it's always been metaphor. Like every record we've made, I feel like I'm always like, this is a metaphor. This is a metaphor for the, like, I feel like I've learned more about the rest of my life from making art every single time we go to make something, because it's, you're involved with something else that's completely out of your control. You're dependent on it. And at the same time, you're hopeful that it'll deliver. You can't really do anything. You can't really make anything happen, but you are essential to the process. It's darkness and light all in one moment. That's what is enticing to me about making art, like whatever it is, whether it's making music, whether it's trying to edit something, whether it's painting something, it's just a participation with something. And I think inside of music, when you're talking with artists, there isn't a language that has been defined by church culture. Mm-hmm. And so people feel like they can actually talk about it a little bit more honestly, because it's uncertain. It's like moving, you know, it's not as pinned down. And that leads to a lot of really beautiful conversations. So, I think it's directly related to beauty.
The only thing I've ever engaged, especially as we get older, that I'm aware of is like just engaging with things that I think are beautiful. And that can be like things that are very backwards to some people's ears. Like if you listen to like the Ronettes or the Supremes, or these type of things, like to my, you know, sensibility, that's like, or it could be like, I mean, it could be Black Sabbath. It could be like anything that's well made and working. You know what I mean? Like you go like, this is as good as it gets. And it could be like Kendrick Lamar, like different things. Yeah. You know, as I get older, I know how odd this is for myself. I'm more quick to cry. Obviously, I cry at my kids' stuff. All the kids like make me cry all the time. But like I'll cry at a pop song. Like, and I mean like bad, cheesy pop songs. Not like maybe current bad cheesy pop songs, but like if it's well made and it's overwhelming. And I was like, that is, and Tim Schill just laughs because I'm like standing in the kitchen making pancakes like, man, this is like really, really great, you know, like in my faith and in my world, like there's only one source for anything that's beautiful, even though, like, you know, people might not be aware or acknowledge or desire, have anything to any desire of where that source of beauty comes from. It doesn't bother me that they wouldn't, that they don't, in my brain, I feel like this is coming from, you know, the same place that all beauty comes from.
Yeah. I think that experience of encounter, like that we have when we're making, when we make something, or even before it's finished and you're kind of like in this conversation, like that's definitely presence. Mm-hmm. Maybe this would be a fault, but I definitely chase that in art all the time and look for that in good art and can feel it when it's happening. Mm-hmm. And it has nothing to do with if the person who's written it is professed a belief. It actually just has to do with, have they put language to what it means to be here and have that encounter with something that I recognize.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, working not in the Christian music world, you're always dealing with people that, like, the best artists coming from people who have no desire to even touch, you know, like, how do you make sense of that? I don't know. I mean, like, good art's good art. And there's no accounting for taste and blah, blah, blah. You know, like, but, you know.
But there is this thing, too, like, I hear it a lot in Christian circles, like, well, because you're a believer, you know, you're closer to the source, like, your art should be better.
I think sometimes that's the opposite case.
No, I actually think that most Christian music that I hear is incredibly awful. I just think
it doesn't work
that way. I think that the priesthood of all believers is a doctrine that makes bad artwork. I'm not saying it's a bad doctrine, but I say it leads to bad artwork. I mean, like, and because you can't be a preacher and a killer pop songwriter. Maybe you can, but it hasn't happened yet in big settings. Like, and it's like, if you're trying to write a good pop song, listen to Be My Baby. You know what I mean? Like, listen to She Loves You, Yeah, Yeah, Yeah. Whatever. It's like the lyrical content, when you're trying to force it into a place of like, I'm going to convince you of the passion narrative and its truth in this 3 minutes. You're destined to make relatively bad artwork unless you are Shakespeare.
Because you're accepting a certain kind of constraint.
Well, and you kind of have to get out of the way. You have to get out of the way of what it's going to do, and it has to trump what you're going to do.
Yeah.
You can't have the last word.
I feel like there's just a misguided, man, you can edit all this out of here because, like,
well,
I know
this making
is highly
enemies,
controversial. But, we have strong opinions about the fact that, like, you can't, like, you're going to lead to insanity. I worry about young people who feel like they get to throw the baby out of the bathwater where it's like, if I don't really go in for all the music, or if I liked it when I was in high school and I get to college and somebody plays me like, fill in the blank, whatever music that's really deeply beautiful and moving and it has no connection to faith, well, then does that mean that this is somehow less valid? It has nothing to do with the truth or falsehood of what, you know, like whatever your, you know, what your faith is talking about. And so I feel like that those confusing, literally confusing those two things, like, is incredibly problematic. And it's actually confused to start with. Like, you hang sheetrock for a living, like, you know, like, do you get home and, like, does your pastor ask you, like, well, how many souls did you convert today? It's like, that's a dumb example, but it's also kind of like hanging sheetrock is a thing. Writing pop songs is a thing. You know what I mean? Like, actually making movies is a thing. There's a ton of bad Christian art. It's like, it's everywhere. And they're not to say that all of it's bad.
Sure.
Because there's a lot of things that are great, but the great things typically aren't hitting you over the head with, like, in case you're wondering.
I think you need to have uncertainty too.
Like, you know,
I think a big thing about it is being uncertain and being okay with being uncertain. And that's like part of what makes good art. And being okay with darkness and being okay with it not being defined. But like also dark and hairy stuff that just is there. That's what makes things beautiful, both things existing and not having an answer about them and not having a definitive statement about what they are, that they're, that you're just participating in it and bearing witness to that, I think is very essential to art being compelling, generative, you know, something that lasts longer.
It's frightening in a sense. It's like this high wire act that if you're going to, whether you want to make music or you want to write novels or whatever, you have to sort of throw yourself out there and let the work guide, like let the imagination guide. I've thought often about kind of Christian art is that it's desperately desiring to be rationally driven, to make sure that we get the right ideas in there, as opposed to kind of letting the imagination in the driver's seat, and the imagination does what it wants to do in a sense, right? Like it takes you places that the rational mind may be really uncomfortable going. So you have to throw yourself into it and just hope you land, right? Hope you stick the landing, I guess.
You can tell when you have an artist who is not being gentle or empathetic or sensitive to in a negative way with you, whether they're Christian artists or not, in a secular way too. Like if they're writing something and they're trying to manipulate you in a dark way, like that, you can tell that too.
Bad,
it's the same problem.
There's plenty of bad secular art.
Yes.
And there's plenty of people who are trying to do the same kind of doctrinal things, whether it's politics or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Actually, the worst songs are protest songs for the most part. You could make the exact same argument that I'm making about it. And I do make that argument if you were like, you know, why don't you write a politically motivated song? It's like, well, you can. It's just that if you plain face it, it just sucks. It's bad. It's just, it's always
it
going
sucks.
To be bad. I mean, like, I think that some of the, even the best artists that are like, I'm writing a political song, it's like, that's the most boring song you're going to write. You know, like, and you almost
Pearl Jam's worst music is their protest music.
Sure. I mean, even like legendary people, like, you know, like Pete Seeger and people who are like, were amazing artists and like, they're like, you don't listen to their whole catalog and go, you know what? Thank you for writing that protest song because it really moves me. He's like, it doesn't. And I hope that it got something done at that moment, but it's bad art. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
for sure.
And you can feel an artist grasping. And that's usually when you're like, this is a beautiful thing. You can see that they're really trying to put language around something. And that's part of it too. And that it's not closed. That they're like, that effort is part of it being beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, not being certain.
I mean, you mentioned Kanye earlier. Like, I think Yeezus is the record that he made the whole record and then he scrapped it and went to the studios with Rick Rubin and kind of redid the whole thing. I mean, I think that record's brilliant. And part of what makes that record brilliant is there is this sense of desperation. There is this sense of, like, you can tell listening to it that he was on a quest for something that eluded him and maybe eluded him to the very end. I mean, but that record has, like, this haunting desperation to it. So.
Yeah.
You're totally right. When you go to hear somebody talk that you want to hear, like I'm going to go to a lecture. I'm going to go to, I mean, nobody goes to lectures, I guess. I'd love to. I love lectures. But like if you go Sunday morning and to hear somebody speak, you know, it's like you're there contextually to be moved in a particular way. And it feels different than when you're going out to go get, you know, like a drink with a friend or a cup of coffee with a friend or going out to watch a movie. I mean, like, you know, like when you watch Netflix, you're in a different, everything's contextually important. And then like hearing a pop song and what you could get out of that emotionally, like hearing that desperation and identifying that in yourself or whatever thing is like, that's incredibly more transformational than somebody explaining anything to you unless you just happen to be motivated by that all the time. And some people maybe are, but like the vast majority of us are not.
But I never had a shot. She was warm, had a way with words, yes. Girls hated her, the boys did not. Then she called me one night, upset, all a mess. She said, I can't stay here, so I lent her some money for a plane ride far from home. Jackie moved to Rome in a people don't know a thing. Some people don't know a thing till they've walked to the very end of the street. Some people don't know a thing. Some people don't learn a thing till they've walked to the very end of the street.
A few years ago, Skip and Tim Schell created something called Drinks With. These are basically interviews, some in American Songwriter magazine, some in their podcast, where they sit down with artists and talk about the creative process. They talk to people like David Sedaris, Dolly Parton, Belle and Sebastian, and more.
We just selfishly wanted to chat with people that we thought were really cool and wanted to hear, because we were making records and writing songs. We were like, man, the first interview we did was a band called Wild Beast from England. Now, yeah. They had their second record came out, and we got invited to play a show with them in New York. It was like the two American shows they were doing. We got an opening slot, which is great. And then they had a ton of good press come out. We'd have never gotten that opening slot if that happened. Yeah. You know, like luckily we were on the bill before this, I think they got Best New Music or something. You know, like whatever it was, it was like, oh, I'm so glad we're on this bill because it wouldn't have happened otherwise.
That's great.
And I was working, I've always done like web development, like in the tour van or whatever. And that now we don't tour at all anymore, really, but that's been like how I've paid the bills. And so I was doing that for American Songwriter magazine, and they were friends of ours, and they were at that time the owners of these two young guys. They're still partial owners, I think. I was like, hey Robert, can I interview this band and ask him about the creative process? He was like, sure, sounds great. So we went in and interviewed those guys first, and it was fun, and they seemed to enjoy it, and we got a kick out of it. And so we did Jason Isbell next, and this is before Southeastern. We had kind of gotten sober and everything, but he was, you could hear that interview. He's sharp as a tack. He was unbelievable when we talk about books, and it was incredible. And then we did Fran Healy from Travis. We were touring. We owned doing a few shows with Jason Isbell back then, so we were just like, oh, cool, we'll do it with the people we tour with.
We started to really do it selfishly because we wanted to either talk to the people that were our friends about making art, but also because we were making records. And like I said, it was like you kind of just want to know all the tricks that everybody does, and you can try it and see if it works for you. You're like, well, maybe this will make it happen this time for us. And then it was so obvious that doesn't get talked about enough between musicians, and it was such a relief to get to talk about it. That was really fun. So then it was like, this is great. And it leads to everything else. Talking about trying to make art really ends up being a conversation about everything else. And it's a doorway into a room that I don't think you could get to as easily as we did. And that was really, really fun. So then we started to do artists, visual artists and writers. And we've done some comedians and some chefs, but it's just kind of we use this context of let's talk about what you do is the craft that you do it. And then it ends up being just a great way to talk friend to friend about what it's like living life, making what we're making.
I think it helps that we're not coming from the journalist side of the world. So you just know what questions not to ask, I guess, to make it awkward. Because you can't ask a comedian. And I actually did this, but you can't say, how do you write a joke? It's just sort of a bit too on the nose. The evolution of that quickly was that we, at that stage when we started to call publicists or whatever, we tried to get Arctic Monkeys. This is ages, 2009.
Yeah.
And because we'd done the Wild Beast interview, they were on the same label. We were able to land an interview when they were kind of saying no to other people because the label had liked this interview. And so we drove to Chicago to do that. That was when we were we're committing to this interview series because we're dropping off our kids at Tim Schell's parents' house. We're driving to Chicago and we're going to chat with these guys. And that interview went really well. And after that, then that was it was easier to say, this is an interview series because we've done all these artists. And then it kind of went forward from there.
Who are some of your favorite interviews you've done?
Alex is always fun. The Arctic Monkeys are always fun. David Sedaris was probably one of the most fun. That was really, really fun. He was so generous, and he's obviously, I think he would be fun for anybody to talk to at any point.
Right.
And he just let us come to his hotel room and talk to him for a really long time.
Yeah.
He was a blessing. I really like talking to Joshua Ferris, who's a writer. It was the first interview I did when we had our last baby, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, we're never going to write again. And I was pretty hormonal. I was sitting there just talking to him. A lot of my questions were normal questions, and then they were like, what if you never think you're ever going to write again? Just very bare. And he was so wonderful. He was just fantastic. I remember him saying, you just want to have really modest expectations. And I've thought about that a zillion times.
Yeah.
He was a great. Who are some of your favorite?
Dolly Parton. Oh, unbelievable.
That was a great interview.
And she was I think they took place 7 in the morning. And that was her second round of interviews that day. So we were we showed up and she was just full Dolly. And I think the thing that was so unbelievable about that, we talked about this yesterday, was we expected her to have the greatest canned answers because she's been doing interviews for like 60 years or whatever. Now we were just like, this is going to be amazing, but I'm expecting sort of her not to, to her to kind of be on autopilot to a degree because totally the opposite. I mean, and we interviewed Kenny Rogers too, which is an amazing interview. He was a little more on autopilot. He'd been like doing interviews all day and it was like, we were here getting great stories and he was as personable as you could imagine, but you didn't really feel like he was ever losing the script that he has, bless his heart. I'm sorry to say blessed, but cut me saying bless her. But like, you know, bless Kenny Rogers. He was, you know, he was like, he'd been doing it for years, and that was great. And I was honored to sit there and hear these answers. That being said, Dolly Parton was like totally engaged with everything and really offended some absolutely bad questions.
Oh, terrible,
you know,
questions
and like
for a lot of people.
And she was like, "Well, yeah, let me think about that." And it was just like, "Oh my gosh, this woman is
she's like really present."
Yeah,
really,
she's like a miracle worker. She's like shooting light from her fingertips.
I also like with musicians, like there's just, and this would always bother me just being a reader and someone who actually liked to learn things, that there's such a stigma to being smart if you do rock music.
Yeah.
And so because we're talking about like, what's your song mean? Either you kind of, you either wiggle under that and you can't move or else you have nothing to say. So it really brought out some great interviews. Like Jason Isbell was fantastic in that regard. And that was great to show that side, to be like, this is important. Like this is a craft that has a history and he's honoring it. And at the time, I remember he was, I guess you were saying that he wasn't so, like that was before the record, but he was reading all the Pulitzers and he was going through them. So we were talking about books and I was like, this is fantastic. Like this isn't going to, people need to hear that he's doing this.
Yeah, he's got this incredible intellect.
And, it's just fantastic. And even like when we did Julian Casablancas, he is such a celebrity. Yeah. And so there's always a moment when we talk to someone like that, I'm sure you would understand, where you're waiting to see which question will get them to forget that.
Yeah.
And you can actually talk to them. And so there was definitely a moment when like,
I don't know when it was, but he shifted, and then he literally started to reverse everything he'd said. We were like, you read any books? He's like, no, I don't read anything, like, not on the road. And then, like, fast forward 20 minutes, and he goes, well, I mean, I do have two books in the tour bus right now, and it's the Iliad and the Bible. And we were just like, and I was like, you know,
it was awesome.
There's a big swing from going to I don't read anything to, you know, I've got the Iliad and the Bible, right? I mean, like, I don't know if it was the Iliad, it might have been the Odyssey. It was Homer, and it was like, that's the one thing we're just trying to do. Sometimes you only have 20 minutes or 30 minutes. And, and it's like, you know, how quickly can we break down whatever's like between two normal people that have never met? They're like, I'll do this all the time. It's fine. And that, you know.
Yeah. Well, and there's something to being like a rock star. Like you have this persona that you have to carry and you have to protect, you know. And so trying to get just under the surface of that and get Julian Casablancas to talk about how he's reading Homer.
Like, he was really like watching a witch melt because he was like, he would tell us about it. He's like, looking in the mirror the whole time, like doing his hair. And then he was like, forget it. By the end, he was totally relaxed.
Nicest, most
that
amazing.
Was nice.
Yeah, but he did, like when we walked in, he was like watching a Mets game and he goes, oh, before we do this interview, he like put on a leather jacket and put on sunglasses. He goes, this is my costume. I'm sorry. It's not you. It's me.
Wow, that's fascinating.
It was incredible. And like, so that was one of our favorite interviews too.
Like everybody is. He's desperate to talk about he works really hard. He works really hard, not on the celebrity, but like on the writing and on the thinking about what he's doing. And so like you barely ever get to talk about that or get to like show that that's part of it. You know, that's a bigger part of it than the celebrity. And so that's neat. It's kind of like, it feels like a gift in that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Noel Gallagher was one of my personal favorites because he was sort of the guy that made me think, oh man, this guy that I could write songs because he wrote, you know, like he was just like from some small town and, you know, he was from Burnage or whatever outside of Manchester. And I was like, when I heard that was like, that was a big inspiration for me and my brother. And so we chatted with him a couple years ago in town and that was like a lot of fun.
You guys have really sort of, between what you're doing with Roman Candle and what you're doing with Drinks With, like you've devoted yourself to the creative process as a whole, you know, there's like, this is a big part of your life. And in like today's economy, that's not a practical thing, you know? So
you're our parents.
So I guess I would say like, why do it? And what would you say to somebody who, you know, you talk to and they're like, yeah, I want to be a writer. I want to be a musician. I want to be an artist. Like, how would you encourage them or discourage them?
John Paul II wrote this letter to artists, which is something I think everybody should read. You don't have to be you have to be a Catholic to read that. And I was like, you don't. It's incredible though because he his story is amazing in that he was really into acting and into drama. Like he has a crazy life story anyway, but he has a really amazing letter that we read early on. I think it's really like newly Catholic, but it basically was, it calls out the idea of, art being a vocation. And then he said, it's really problematic to sort of intertwine commerce with that, mm-hmm. or an expectation for some sort of, and that was unfortunately not what we wanted to hear, because we were like, I'd like to make a living at this. But it was incredibly encouraging over time, because out of the gate, having no expectation there, it gave us kind of license, I feel like, to pursue the things that made sparks in our imagination. And that's kind of what we've done, for better or for worse. And we haven't made a nickel on anything in a long time. And it's not been glamorous in that way.
A couple nickels.
That's true. But like, but I have really worked, and anybody that knows us and our family like knows, like, I work for the Preemptive Love Coalition, and I have like a full on like job doing that's come out of like web development and other things. There was a time we actually decided like either we could, especially living in Nashville, you can like do things that will allow you to potentially make more money. Like, let's get in with the guys that are going to write songs that are basically just to fill a spot in Grey's Anatomy. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think it's amazing. And but you're also trying to hit a mood. It's a different exercise. It's like building a cabinet.
Yeah.
And we were like, we have limited amount of time to do this mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. day with our family. Like, do we want to try and gamble on that? Or do we just want to do the things that we feel called mm-hmm. to do? And we ended up doing that. And that is honestly I would recommend somebody do the same, unless you're really good at the cabinet making, and a lot of people are. If you're great at that, it comes natural, and you do it, run with it. But
even our friends who do that will say it's a very different animal than making records. Like, it's just a completely different animal.
And we didn't want to. I think the things we kept saying is we can't put pressure on music to make money, or else we'll hate it.
Yeah.
And
we love it too much.
Yeah.
We just went and saw George Saunders speak and don't want to talk about politics, but he was responding kind of to politics and was saying, my response is just keep making art. I think as an artist, you constantly feel like, I know that I'm supposed to be making it. And then, is there any purpose? That's just like your life question. Yeah. Like, that's your own psychosis that you just carry with you. But I feel like every single time, at all time, is so essential, because if there weren't artists making art, you wouldn't have empathy. You wouldn't have curiosity. You wouldn't have... It's so essential to our culture. And when we kind of polarize ourselves, art is the thing that allows there to be fluidity between the two poles. And so I think, like, especially whether you're making money on it or not, if you can make it, just keep doing it, because it is so essential and it's so undervalued, and we really, really need it as a culture.
Now first he sings and then he goes, and what it means, it's hard to know.
Man, I love those two people. All right, my friend Lachlan complained recently that we aren't doing previews anymore, so stay tuned, Lachlan, and you'll hear a preview of next week's show. But first, Cultivated is a production of Harbor Media and the Narrativo Group. If you want to learn more about Narrativo, go to narrativogroup.com. Our link's in our show notes. Our show today was produced by me. It was recorded and edited by TJ Hester. It was mixed by Mark Owens. Our music today was by Roman Candle. We've got one episode left for 2017, and it's a doozy. So come back next week for my conversation with screenwriter, creator of the TV show Billions, and host of my favorite podcast, Brian Koppelman.
You know, the line between being delusional, being an artist, is very thin, right? Because you're crazy right up until it works. That is the same as in a startup in a certain way. I mean, because that messianic thing can be bad. I mean, you and I have talked about that in a different context. I know you feel it too, that it can be a bad thing. And so when you have that certainty, you just have to, run some checks on yourself in some way. I mean, it's important to know, like, I didn't think that the thing I was going to start and write right away was going to be great. I just knew I had to start doing it to feel like a person, to feel alive.
See you next week.
This episode was brought to you in part by United We Pray. United We Pray is a podcast devoted to praying and thinking about racial strife, especially between Christians. Come join us in praying for the unity of God's people.